This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Spencer Reese. His book, The Clerk's Tale, has just been published by Houghton Mifflin, and it is the talk of the poetry world. And here's Spencer Reese with an opening poem.
Chrysanthemums. When I am in the hospital, there is this boy. He is 17 and has survived a circus fire. His eye sockets are gouges. The eyes themselves are like slugs, inching. His fingers are missing, the stumps are black. When the nurse undoes his gauze bandages, his mouth collapses. The shower room is soundproofed, so we cannot hear the screams when they debride him. The hours pass, quick, then slow. Outside my window, the chrysanthemums, their petals yellow and scalloped as woodcuts.
The voice of Spencer Reese. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're celebrating this new book. This is Spencer Reese's first book, and it's making a pretty big set of fireworks, I think. He's frowning at me, but he's been through quite a journey since it was selected for publication. Spencer Reese was chosen as the Witter Binner Fellow here at the Library of Congress by Louise Glick, who was our poet laureate. And this started a whole series of events which have, I guess, not ended yet and will continue maybe for the rest of your life. Tell us, Spencer, about the advent of this book. How long was it in coming?
Oh, well, first of all, I just want to thank you for interviewing me, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I wanted to tell you that. This book has been with me for a long, long time, probably over 20 years. I lose track. And certainly before these events occurred to bring me out of obscurity, I had pretty much given up on the idea that anything would ever happen. So it just came as a complete shock.
So it was chosen. You submitted it into a contest.
I had been submitting this book for over 10 years.
It's those first readers that kill it. I would like to get a hold of those first readers. But finally, it was selected by the judges, I guess, the first judges. And then Louise Glick was the final judge, and it was the Bakeless Award.
Right.
Given by Middlebury College's Bread Loaf Conference.
Right.
So that started it out. And here you had been submitting poems here and there and probably feeling pretty bad about this time. And then this happened.
I wasn't feeling bad. I'd just come to terms with the fact that I probably do it for my own entertainment and not for anybody else to see. Although I did not give up hope. I did keep trying to submit it, but I thought everything was rigged, or that people had to know somebody or go to a certain graduate school, and I just didn't have any of that. So I thought mistakenly that's what was going on. But in my case is an example that you don't have to know anybody.
Spencer Reese was born in Connecticut. He lives in Lantana, Florida, and he is assistant manager of Brooks Brothers in Palm Beach. The title poem, The Clerk's Tale, which is the title of the book, was featured in the New Yorker magazine on their back page, which is a very special and privileged place. You have been written up by the New Yorker magazine. You have been applauded at Bread Loaf. You're giving readings every time there's a lull in the conversation and you have a moment off from work. Is this going to affect Brooks Brothers sales?
Well, I hope if it does, it'll be positively.
Yes. In Florida now, where you once were known as a manager of a clothing store, an elegant clothing store with a beautiful tradition and one that you take pride in.
Yeah.
All of a sudden now, the store is a buzz because you have taken a different image. So people that come into the store may know about this, right?
That has occurred, and it's been a bit disarming because I'm not used to that. But it hasn't, it's been a little strange.
It hasn't disrupted any, the commerce?
No, and everybody's been so pleasant.
Why shouldn't they be thrilled about this?
Yeah.
Because this is a great thing that's happened. The first reading you ever gave was at the Library of Congress. That is not a bad initiation. Spencer Reese, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress. We're going to hear more from The Clerk's Tale. So let's hear another poem.
Okay, sure. This poem is called Midnight, and I wrote it, as I was saying to you, this book is written over a long period of time, so a lot of time is being covered. And this poem was written when I lived on a farm in rural southern Minnesota. And it's simply about living on that farm and taking a walk. And it begins with a quote from a favorite novel of mine by E.M. Forrester called Howard's End. And the quote from that book is, "I quite expect to end my life caring most for a place." I think that's all I need to tell you. The farm that I lived on was on an old Indian campground, and across the way, every morning when I woke up, there was an old Indian burial mound. So that's what it's about, and taking a walk. Midnight. Pine trees stir in a chorus of darkness. The lake taps the shore as if to tell me something. A light rain increases the abstractions. All edges blur. Dark, tilled fields stretch for miles. The Midwest settles into my chest. Colts bolt across untouched Dakota acres, alive with the cymbal smash of affectionate caresses. Farms, barns, somnolent cows, empty gravel roads, and distant houses make up the landscape I walk in, where once, a long time ago, Indians slept and walked, dissolving into the shadows with tenderness. On Andy Cleland's farm, the one closest to the lake, where cattails flourish at the water's edge, there is one huge hill, vacant of shrubbery. I was told once it was an Indian burial mound, and that was why no tree or bush would grow on that hill. All these years later, and the hill is still bald, whispering softly as the revolutions of the sea, echoing with the mouths of the vanquished. Sheep maraud across the hill's back, exhilarated by the dirt smells born again by spring. The wind haunted with the songs of comrades now gone. The rest of this panorama is immense, dark, impenetrable, unstructured. But if you look closely, in the left-hand corner, I can just be distinguished from the blue, blue brilliance of all this land. A tiny figure, no bigger than a grass blade, a shadow hugged by shadows, heading home after a long walk nowhere, encircled by a halo of rocks, trees, crops, rivers, clouds, by every blessed thing conspiring together to save my life.
The voice of Spencer Reese. Louise Glick said, like all genuinely new work, Spencer Reese's compels a reevaluation of the possible. Now, would it be fair to say that this book is a template of your autobiography? I mean, Can we characterize your book that way, that the poems do spring from events in your life? Is that one way to describe the book?
They definitely do, although hopefully, as I believe Sylvia Plath once said in an interview on the BBC right at the end of her life, she hoped that they would be more than a mirror-looking, narcissistic, locked-box sort of experience. So, yeah.
No one could accuse you of that because they are... I have read this book several times.
Well, bless your heart.
And each time I read a poem, it's new. I thought, I didn't read this before. And there is something about the words that are prisms. There is, of course, the right word in the right order. There is an impeccable choice of words and an elegance and sophistication in your work. But it is always changing colors for me. I doubt if it will ever be a locked box of any sort, even a box of mirrors. If we give up loss, what do we have left? You have taken loss and made it a fecund thing, a quality of nourishment. Can you describe that? Do you agree?
Well, I never thought about it exactly as you just put it, but that was well put. Yes, and I mean that does have to do with my my biography. The book does cover several losses, and that, you know, weren't planned. They just occurred. Both property. I mean, this place. This poem I just read about, this farm I love more than anything. I thought I would live there the rest of my life. And then it was sold, so...
And that had a devastating effect. You had to... I know the poem, you had to give away the dog. Was that the same place? So, to hark back to the beginning, you went to college in Maine.
I did. I started at Bowdoin.
Did you know Herb Corson? Was he there then?
I did know him.
Yes, I like him.
He was a great Shakespeare teacher.
He is. Yep. He's retired now, but we're in touch. He's a wonderful poet. So you left there.
I doubt he would remember me.
I'll make sure he does. Wait till he reads The New Yorker.
It was a long time ago.
Sure. Then you went to Wesleyan.
I transferred from Bowdoin to Wesleyan after 2 years at Bowdoin, yeah.
Then you studied at Harvard Divinity School.
That's correct, yep. And I went to England for a year in between, and I received a master's in English Renaissance poetry. And upon returning, I went to the Divinity School.
Did you receive a degree?
Yes.
And what did you learn from that experience?
At the Divinity School?
If you had to just say one thing that you came away with that maybe has instructed your poetry.
I really began thinking seriously about this book there at the Divinity School. So I thought I was going to become a hospital chaplain, and it seemed clear that that wasn't going to be my calling. And so it seemed that as harebrained and pie in the sky as the idea was, that perhaps I was being called to poetry.
Well, in your poems, one of the characters is silence. I mean, when you look at Beckett, one of his characters is light. And that is a full-fledged character in his work. Silence is a character.
In whose work?
Beckett's work, Light, is a character on stage.
Oh.
It takes on a persona.
Samuel Beckett, yeah.
Yes. And your work, I would say the same. Silence is a character who enters the scenes. And the silence is so important. You talk about it.
Yes.
You mentioned being mute and speaking for the dead. You are very in touch with silence. You go to church, perhaps, for silence.
I do.
And
I think you hear God in silence.
I believe that's where God lives.
Yes, so the more that I can have of that, the better.
Yeah.
Because that brings me closer to God.
And so that's where I am led in your poetry, where the serenity is, I think, one of the reasons why people love your poetry. I think it makes them feel better. Some of the subjects are rude, too rude for human concepts, the pain, the loss, the cruelty others put on each other. But from that comes this great sense of something transcendent.
Well, I think that's just God working through me. I don't know how much credit I can take for that.
I think you have to wiggle the words around on the page, though. That's your job, right?
Yeah.
And I think you did that. Spencer Reese is at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're talking about The Clerk's Tale. And maybe you should tell us what The Clerk's Tale represents. What is that poem from?
Well, it goes back to Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales, and this seemed to me like an appropriate metaphor, going on a pilgrimage. In a sense, the whole book is a pilgrimage, and a pilgrimage of loss and of searching for meaning. And in many ways, the poems are simply prayers.
Mm.
And, you know, the idea in the Canterbury Tales where they sit in a circle and tell a tale is something that, interested me and seemed appropriate to the book. Specifically, the clerk was a student in the Canterbury Tales, and he told the tale of a marriage. And so the simple idea behind that poem was that I was going to speak of another marriage, and it was the marriage of the man who taught me the business of retail, and the speaker, because in my work life, very often it's like being married, and one does spend so much time with these people. So that was. I think that covers it more or less.
Yes, Spencer is the assistant manager of Brooks Brothers, and so this is something people have fastened on to, and I think rightly so. He's been written up. What he was wearing was written up in an article by The New Yorker. People make a lot of the clothing industry. We had Wallace Stevens in insurance, didn't we? We had T.S. Eliot in a bank. We've never had anyone from the fashion industry before. And so there's an irony there with the clerk being the clerk. I think some people make
yes.
that, of course.
Oh, yes, right. I forgot to mention that.
And yeah. So there's a lot going on in this book. Now, in your own life, tragedy sometimes propels us on to better things. And you talk about having a breakdown after your stint at Divinity School. And then you are hospitalized, and there are some poems that come out of that. And then a beautiful thing happens. You make a friend in the hospital. Would you comment on that, please? The nurse who
yes,
spoke with
sure.
you? I think that's very significant. What happened there?
Sure.
You met someone who was kind in the
yeah.
hospital.
Well, I was in the process of losing the farm, and I was in the process of a break with my parents, which was very, very difficult and complex, but the issues, and they're addressed in the book, had to do with alcoholism and sexuality, and it was pretty much a nightmare, and I'd never really come to terms with it, and I was being forced to look at myself, my authentic self, and so I was kind of stripped of everything, and I got to the hospital, and, well, it was very difficult, and I met a nurse there, and she befriended me.
You read a poem, but it was not your own, you said. Was it Elizabeth Bishop? Is that what I remember?
Oh, yes, that's right. You read that interview
a
in
write-up.
The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after I've been there a little bit, I recited to her a poem by Elizabeth Bishop, and she was very affected by it. One art from her book Geography 3, and she began to cry, and so we became friends, and she and her husband single-handedly changed my life, and I ended up living in their living room for 3 years, which was really just sort of an extended hospitalization. I didn't work for that whole period, and they took care of me and brought me back. So
that's a good line. Brought me back. Let's hear another poem. Spencer okay, Rees, sure. Reading from The Clerk's Tale.
Once I met the nurse, then I met her husband, who was from England, and I was losing the farm. The great coincidence, I don't know if you've had this in your own life, but these amazing coincidences that come in right when we need them, I think of as God's grace. And I had to be sent to the city, but the nurse was from the tiny little town where I lived on the farm, which was far away. So this was bizarre in itself. I met her husband, and we became great friends, and he became like a father to me, something that I'd been missing. And he loved me, and he believed in my poetry, largely due to him. I started to get a lot better, and I did everything with this couple for many years. They were much older than me. They were in their 70s. And he just passed away this December. He did know about the book, and he was very excited about it. And they read this poem at his funeral. It's called Ponies, and it's simply about a day that we had together. And if I get through it without a tear, I'll be lucky. So, ponies. I remember the ponies in the distance. I remember you talked of a war. No, two wars. A failed marriage. Discreetly, without force or grandeur. This was before they amputated your leg. Before the stroke. You rolled your R's, spoke of Oxford, recalled driving in the Quaker ambulance unit in China, where you saw an oil drum filled with severed limbs. Pleased to have your approval, I rarely spoke. You were like a father to me, and I was grateful. I remember the ponies behind the fence, muscular, breathing, how they worried the grass. The ponies said, "This day astounds us. The field is green. We love nothing better than space and more space." Ah, they knew what I needed to know. They lived in their bodies. If the ponies wanted to kiss, they kissed. They moved like the shadows of airplanes. They knew no hatred, but fear they understood. The sky was shot clear with blue. After the picnic, we gathered the tablecloth. As we left, I could still see the ponies, crowding one another, free and unbroken.
Beautiful. That is a beautiful poem. Read us another.
This is about his wife, Martha, who was my nurse there in the hospital. To Martha, my nurse, I leave the open unit, and I am not afraid. I rent a room with a few flies. There is no sea for me to see, only these wheat fields beat by the sun. I had hoped for the sea, but no. The sun shines on the gray cat who purrs on the steamer trunk. You have sent me on my way. The hospital floats in the city like a yacht. This new room is bright yellow. I nail a crucifix upon one wall. The crucifix is from Latin America. A white Christ embraced by orange. The Christ says, believe in me. It is nearly 2 in the afternoon. There is much to do, much to see.
One theme and one line which keeps reoccurring in your work is, I am not afraid. I think that's a remarkable recitative. It keeps coming back. I've seen it in many poems.
Yeah.
And you can talk about a situation of complete emptiness and loss and abandonment, and then it will come like a light. I am not afraid. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's faith. I think that's all it is.
Also being inside the poem. I was thinking that being inside the poem is a safe place to be as you're writing it. So that line might come up from the safety of closure in the meditation of space, writing the poem.
Yes.
There's much to be afraid of, God knows.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah.
Are you aware of all the things you do in your poems?
No, probably not.
Probably not.
No.
It's a good thing.
I mean, some things, sure.
Mm-hmm. For instance, the iconography of the crucifix shows up many times.
Oh, it does. Okay.
A couple of times.
Not
only, but never singled out as a piety figure or emblem. It comes through the poem as an aesthetic image most often, an ornament, because there is a lot of beautiful imagery in your work. I mean, I would say that the visual detail is extraordinary.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
You didn't know it?
That what?
That your visual element was dominant, the imagery?
No, but that's... I mean, I think sometimes a lot of poets, I can't speak for any but myself, really, but I think I'm a frustrated painter. I mean, I love paintings.
Yeah.
After I leave you, I'm going to go to the National Gallery, and I just... So sometimes I think when I'm writing a poem, I really wish I was painting.
Spencer Reese, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Read us another poem.
This poem is called Etude, and as well as being a frustrated painter, I guess I'd say I'm a frustrated piano player. I do play the piano, and I took lessons for many years, but was not truly gifted. But I think it informs my writing as well. And an etude is something, if you've ever taken piano, that in the beginning years that you're learning piano, often you'll be assigned etudes, which are simply studies, practices. And if you repeat them enough, you'll get better. Etude. Go to the gay bar where the young and old men flirt. Listen to their conversations, short and curt. Study the dance music thumping in your chest. Maybe mention how there is more of an emphasis on anticipation as opposed to the event. It might help you along a bit if helping along is what you require. A century has ended. A new one begins. This small seaside city is done in faux Tuscan. Note the overly made-up women in Chanel suits nodding inside the banquettes of the fancy restaurants. They wait, as we all must wait. Smell the villas heavy with hibiscus, gardenias, and grapettes. This is America. This is Florida, where history is rarely exact, and the seduction of beauty is all. Feel the city gather on your skin, the dirt, the exhaust, the laundry steam, the brine. Let the tip of your tongue taste the ruined domes of the churches corroded by the Atlantic. Observe the windows reflecting the police cruisers that go red-blue, red-blue, red-blue. Listen to the bombardier beetles strum their instruments. See the lamps of the big estates brighten. mark the stands of casuarina pine solidifying. And if a new friend should take your arm, do not define the gesture. No. Let the moon spread her shampoo all over you. Allow the palm trees with their shallow roots to lull you down the broad avenue.
Spencer Reese of the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're talking about The Clerk's Tale. There are a series of ghazals, or hazals, the Iranians say. And I think you have seven ghazals.
I have two poems called, I guess I say ghazal. That's what I learned in when I took a class at Harvard. That's how I learned about this form.
And what form is it? Can you describe it?
Well, it's a Persian form of poetry. It's mainly, its origins are, it's a spiritual love poetry that was started by the great Sufi love poet Rumi, who dedicated his ghazals to Shams Tabriz, who it was through, he believed that through this person, this best friend, he was able to see the divine. And they're couplets, and each couplet is its own poem, and you string them together like beads on a necklace that you offer to the beloved.
That's how it was taught to me.
Sure. Yep. This is the end of the ghazals for spring. And it's the part seven of that. And this poem interweaves a joy of spring that one truly realizes living in Minnesota, where the seasons are so dramatic. And also the theme of the Holocaust is woven throughout. And the theme of love, I think those are the themes as I remember correctly. So this is the last one. So they jump around the way the mind jumps around from one couplet to the next, but hopefully they all string together.
Is there any rule, like the second word has to rhyme with the third word of the fourth line?
There are those rules.
Did you observe them?
I broke them all. The only one I kept was that each couplet stands on its own as a poem. That's the only thing that I kept. I didn't. You're supposed to rhyme them all, and you're supposed to put your name somewhere at the end of it, I believe. But that was too self-reflective.
And you're
for
supposed
me.
To write them in Persians, but
yeah, I didn't do that
well,
either.
Well, see, you can't follow the rules.
But what I do like, especially with this current horrible war going on, is that something beautiful from that. I was able to take something beautiful from that culture and honor it.
I like that.
So part seven, this is seven couplets on those themes that I mentioned. This warm, juicy symphony, sweat and spit, stir and slip, inviting the dirt's lips to split. The shrill agendas of alcoholics surround us. I meet a 70-year-old Jewish woman named Margot who survived Auschwitz and fertility experiments. What will the spring flowers say to her this year? Pussy willows open their tattered pocketbooks like aristocrats escaping who produce heirlooms at dawn and beg the border guards for political asylum. Floorboards creak all night long in our house. The ghosts must go soon. All night they tremble and fold their secrets in the growing heat of the trees. The mirror is smoke-colored. Shadows flit across its surface like anxious squirrels. Shark-eyed, the mirror says, unleash your opera. And when I think of spring, I think of love. I remember again the night my roots exploded and mud sloshed in my guts. Oh, spring, beautiful spring, how you resex the swinging trees and sing our trembling skins to sleep.
Mm. There are poems in your book which are very difficult poems, and they came from a difficult place. And I could say that despair was a currency in the work that may have been maybe the fuel to make you sit down. And what always interests me, and especially with this book, is out of despair, yet energy is generated. Where does that energy come from when you are in a back ward of a hospital room, not knowing if you're going to stop trembling, if your brother will ever speak to you again, your parents will, you still haven't reconciled. All of these things of this earth are pressuring on you, and yet energy creeps up between the cracks and creates a work of art that shines and shines for everyone to see. How do you explain that?
Well, I see a nun now for spiritual direction, and we meet once a month. And I think of my poems as prayers. So prayer comes out of that place, too, where one is faced with adversity or betrayal, as Jesus had to deal with, or, you know, so many, whatever it is that we have to come to terms with.
But the energy, the physical energy, I mean, as I get older, it's harder for me to write theater because theater takes conflict, and conflict takes energy.
Uh-huh.
You know, energy is a real thing to an artist.
Right.
You know, you have to stand on your head, I burn candles.
Uh-huh.
You know, whatever you can do to get through it. And I see this powerful energy in your work, and I just marveled at it. I just said, where do we get this at a time when you think, you know, the world is all gray, up comes this brilliant piece of yellow. have you thought into that as well,
well
as lived
it? Must be a different sounding energy from, say, Sylvia Plath's Ariel, which was written so rapidly and so fast, also in moments of great despair and loss.
Yeah.
Whereas I wrote over a really long period of time and endured.
Yours is called a patient craft. Someone called it patient craft.
So yeah. The energy maybe comes from endurance.
Mm.
It reminds me of, I ran track in high school and I keep running my whole life. And you need endurance to be a long distance runner. Even if you're no good, you have to keep going. Even if you're the last one in the race, and sometimes I was, but you have to finish it out. So
I just met a young man yesterday who's going to swim the English Channel, and he 21 miles, and he's practicing. And I said to my husband, but you know, he looks so frail. He doesn't seem, there's not musculature, you know, I'm worried about him. And my husband said, but it's in your mind. It's in his mind. And that's where the training is. So that says a lot.
Yeah.
One more poem. You know what? We haven't talked about interior.
Oh, okay.
That's a good poem.
All right, sure. I don't normally read this one.
Well, I got you reading all of the ones you put in the pack.
Yeah. I haven't given that many readings. This poem is called Interior. And it's about a day working in a jewelry stores, unlike the sort of retail I'm involved in at Brooks Brothers. It moves very, very slowly, and one sale can take over a week.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
And I worked in the jewelry trade for a year, and so I guess this comes from that time there. Interior. The jewelry shop is a small stage. The very rich enter and exit like actors in a Beckett play. The salesman fills the bowl of nuts. The bell rings, the door opens. He smiles and will not be grim. He talks of rubies, pearls, and clasps. The day roars, speeds past him, splinters light apricot shards that fleck the man's cheeks. The phone before him persists. On his desk, with brass handles, a framed photo of Princess Diana, who used to wear these jewels. Today there's a bit of gossip about a certain dissolute grandee. Each day there is new traffic. It is hard to recall who is who. The old single female manager coughs in spasms, steals sales, ruminates over her childless state, and orders the salesman around. Each day he forgives her anew. As the light leaves the window, he surveys all the silver objects he will soon be asked to polish. The tired man forgets and remembers in equal proportions as he drinks his last cup of bitter black coffee.
Spencer Reese. I was going to have you read another one, but I want to leave enough room for The Clerk's Tale, which will take 6 minutes. So before we do that, you have to talk a little bit about clothing. I mean, do clothes make the man? I think they do.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. I know that you...
About clothes?
Yeah.
Talk about clothes?
Talk about Brooks Brothers. I mean, this has a tradition. You entered that tradition, and you further that tradition.
Yes.
By believing in the product.
Yes, it's a great product, and we're the oldest clothier in the United States. We outfitted Abraham Lincoln in his suit that he was assassinated in, and all the presidents, you know, John F. Kennedy wore Brooks Brothers suits, and Katharine Hepburn bought her men's pants at Brooks Brothers, and so there's a long, long history.
Are they made to order? I mean, they're not off the rack. The presidents, they come in and do tailor them.
The presidents now, I don't know the answer to that. They do made-to-measure trunk shows in each of the stores where a tailor will come in. But also there's, you know, off-the-rack suits for most everybody.
What's the thing for fall, or is it always the same?
We're basically always the same. We have the corner on the market of conservative and boring. Everything is blue.
It will almost be blue again this
almost
year?
Almost everything is navy blue with some pinstripes. And there's, you know, it's not a fashion house, really. I mean, there's no designer behind it. It's just a container of a capsule of tradition. And, I mean, clothes, if you really think about them psychologically, are, I mean, interesting. I mean, what people wear and the fact, the difference it makes for young children if they're in uniforms or if they get to pick what they wear. And it's interesting. And
the uniforms the shirt you have on now is a Brooks Brothers
yes,
shirt.
Yes, it is.
And it's a short sleeve white, would we say percale maybe? It's a very fine cotton.
It's a non-iron shirt. These shirts are something that we came out with about, I think, 10 years ago.
It looks
iron.
And
they don't wrinkle.
Mm.
So you just press them and they stay crisp all
day
long.
How much is it?
But if you get three of them, it's three for, well, if you buy them during a sale, this is a short sleeve one, so.
And you get a discount, I hope.
I sure do.
Well, do you have beautiful clothing? Do you have racks and racks and closets of beautiful clothing?
I try not to have too much of an excess, but, you know, it is the one thing that I
You're immersed in it.
Yeah, so I do have more than I ever imagined.
I worked for Dunham's department store all through high school, and I spent more than I made. I just kept putting things on layaway, you know.
It happens. It happens. Yeah.
Well, you're living two lives, but living them beautifully, I think, and making them mesh together very well as you start your poetry career as a professional poet, as well as a person who has a working job.
Yeah.
And when you go back, you've been to Middlebury. You've been featured there for 2 weeks, right?
Right.
Went reading to and talking to people.
A lot of reading, a lot of talking. There were
writers' conference.
Writers everywhere.
First
writers.
Time you were immersed in that?
No. Actually, I went to Breadloaf 21 years ago when I was in college. I was one of the younger people.
But you were
there.
Featured this time.
Yeah.
As their star, in a way, because this is the winner of their prize.
Well, there were many stars.
Yes. Every poet is a star.
There were many, many.
And you're just coming
there.
Back from that.
I am just coming off of that.
And then you're going home pretty soon after a reading in Washington.
I read here, I read in New York City, and I go to work the next morning.
Mm-hmm. Where are you reading in New York?
I'm reading at the New School.
Oh, excellent.
On Friday night.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, let us hear The Clerk's Tale.
Okay. This poem, just by way of introduction, is basically a tribute to a coworker. It's a portrait, really, of the man who taught me about retail, because I didn't know anything about retail at all when I started 8 years ago, and so nothing pleases me more than the fact that he might be remembered. I think very often with my coworkers, there's a sense of not being appreciated, or that it's a job that not always people pay attention.
And this was not written about the Palm Beach Brooks Brothers.
No, this was when I started in Minneapolis at the Mall of America, the largest freestanding mall in the United States, which was quite a shock after living on a farm, let me tell you. And I was not I wasn't crazy about malls. But anyway, here's the poem. The Clerk's Tale. I am 33 and working in an expensive clothier, selling suits to men I call sir. These men are muscled, groomed, and cropped, with wives and families that grow exponentially. Mostly I talk of repties and bow ties, of full Windsor knots and half Windsor knots, of Tattersall, French cuff, and English spread collars, of foulards, neats, and internationals, of pincord, houndstooth, nailhead, and sharkskin. I often wear a blue pinstripe suit. My hair recedes and is going gray at the temples. On my cheeks there are a few pimples, for my terrible eyesight, horn-rimmed spectacles. One of my fellow workers is an old homosexual who works hard and wears bracelets with jewels. No one can rival his commission checks. On his break, he smokes a Benson and Hedges cigarette, puffing expectantly as a Hollywood starlet. He has carefully applied a layer of Clinique bronzer to enhance the tan on his face and neck. His hair is gone, except for a few strands which are combed across his scalp. He examines his manicured, lacquered nails. I admire his studied attention to details. His tie stuck to his shirt with masking tape, his teeth capped, his breath mint in place. The old homosexual and I laugh in the back over a coarse joke involving an octopus. Our banter is staccato, staged, and close, like those Spanish dances by Granados. I sometimes feel we are in a musical, gossiping backstage between our numbers. He drags deeply on his cigarette. Most of his life is over. Often he refers to himself as an old faggot. He does this bemusedly, yet timidly. I know why he does this. He does this because his acceptance is finally complete, and complete acceptance is always bittersweet. Our hours are long, our backs bent. We are more gracious than English royalty. We dart amongst the aisles tall as hedgerows. Watch us fade into the merchandise. How we set up and take apart mannequins as if we were performing autopsies. A naked body without pretense is of no use. It grows late. I hear the front metal gate close down. We begin folding the ties correctly according to color. The shirts, oxfords, broadcloths, pinpoints, must be sized, stacked, or rehashed. The old homosexual removes his right shoe, allowing his gigantic bunion to swell. There is the sound of cash being counted, coins clinking, bills swishing, numbers whispered. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We are changed when the transactions are done. Older, dirtier, dwarfed. A few late customers gawk in at us. We say nothing. Our silence will not be breached. The lights go off, one by one. The dressing room lights, the mirror lights. Then it is very late. How late? 11? We move to the gate. It goes up. The gate's grating checkers our cheeks. This is the Mall of America. The light is bright and artificial, yet not dissimilar to that found in a Gothic cathedral. You must travel down the long hallways to the exits before you encounter natural light. One final formality. The manager checks our bags. The old homosexual reaches into his over-the-shoulder leather bag, the one he bought on his European travels with his companion of many years. He finds a stick of lip balm and applies it to his lips liberally, as if shellacking them. Then he inserts one last breath mint and offers one to me. The gesture is fraternal and occurs between us many times. At last we bid each other good night. I watch him fade into the many-tiered parking lot where the thousands of cars have come and are now gone. This is how our day ends. This is how our day always ends. Sometimes snow falls like rice. See us take to our dimly lit exits, disappearing into the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Minneapolis is sleek, and St. Paul, named after the man who had to be shown, is smaller, older, and somewhat withdrawn. Behind us, the moon pauses over the vast, egg-like dome of the mall. See us loosening our ties among you. We are alone. There is no longer any need to express ourselves.
The voice of Spencer Reese. The book is The Clerk's Tale. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series has been brought to you by Forest Woods Media Productions. It is made possible by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the D.C. Council on the Humanities. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Additional funding for The Poet and the Poem is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art.